Okay, session number 12371, and this is reel 4.
Reel 4.
Yeah, somebody said, surely if we keep flying from here to Hanover and back, the Germans are going to hoist this in and they'll be waiting for us. And the squadron commander said, that's a very good point. And he got on to advanced air striking force, and they took this point as well. And so they said, all right, if you think that you're in danger of being attacked, you can fly out over neutral Holland and land in Norfolk, get your films developed there, and then fly back here over the channel. Well, with the opportunity of going back to UK, it was rather funny, but all the married men in the squadron started to volunteer for these sorties. I can't remember how many of these daylight sorties we carried out, but not very many. And I think the only thing of note that was seen, one of our pilots flying off the Pantan, as he was then, saw some German fighters taking off about 20,000 feet below him, but he never saw anything more after that. And I think that was the only incident that was seen on these few daylight sorties we did. But as I say, people took this opportunity of being able to go back to England over neutral Holland. But very soon, I think it was the CO of 18 Squadron, Wing Commander Day, better known as Pricky Day, and who became very famous as a British prisoner of war. Wings Day, he was also known as. In those days, I think he was known as Pricky Day. And I think he was the CO of 18 Squadron. He may be in the CO of 57, I really can't remember, but he was the CO of one of the two Lenin squadrons that should have come out to France and in whose place we were sent instead to Plevo. He arrived because his squadron was now going to come out and relieve us. And he learnt from our squadron commander what we'd been doing and what experience we'd learnt from what we had done. So now 53 Squadron ceased these operations and moved to their correct base, which was Poix, which is not very far from Amiens. During the move, I was the officer in charge of the rear party. In other words, I was responsible for cleaning up and making sure that we left everything as we found it, not only on the airfield, but down in the village. And so I had a party of about 20 men. And when we finally departed, we departed in a 3-ton lorry. It took quite some time to get to Poix, and I remember we left very, very early in the morning, and I didn't have time to shave. And when we arrived in Poix, I found that the officers' mess, which was in a building in the middle of Poix, was next door to a barber's. And so I went into the barber shop to get a shave. And I sat in the chair, and a woman came into the shop from the back. And in my basic French, I said that I wanted a shave. She then proceeded to start getting the brushes out and the razor and everything. And I could see that she was going to shave me. Well, of course, in those days, such a thing was almost unheard of. And so again, I said in my rudimentary French, had she got a husband? She said, yes, he was in the Lit Maginot. So I was now convinced that I was going to be shaved by a woman. She didn't use a cutthroat razor, which is probably just as well, but she took a Gillette razor. She took out a brand new blade out of its paper, and she carefully took it out and put it in the razor. I was sitting in this chair absolutely scared stiff. She then soaped my face, and then she put the razor on my face and went woof, and then woof like that, and she was about to shave my upper lip upwards, and I grabbed the razor out of her hand, and I quickly finished the job and paid her and ran out of the shop. Funnily enough, that barber shop is still in Poix, although Poix took very heavy damage both in 1940 and in 1944. Well, we were now back, ready to resume the role that we were trained for. And my participation really was about to cease, because before the war, I had been played in top-class amateur football, and my squadron were now to play football against number two squadron, and I was going to be the goalkeeper, which was my position. And during this match, I got hit under the jaw with somebody's head, and I was absolutely laid cold, and I played the rest of the match completely unconscious. I hadn't the remotest idea what was going on until right near the end of the game, when I suddenly came to, apparently having not let in a goal and been rather aggressive to everybody. And I came to, and I was standing in between the goalposts. The game was going on at the other end of the field, and for some reason or another, I thought I was on Hampstead Heath. The result of this was that I got concussion, and I was first of all put to bed in my billet, which was a spotlessly clean little house belonging to a retired teacher and her postman husband. She insisted on looking after me herself, and I always remember the treat of the day was when she bought me hot chocolate and chestnuts. But eventually I was carted off to the British Military Hospital in Arras, and after a fortnight I was sent on sick leave back to the United Kingdom for about 3 weeks. I can't remember the exact time now. Well, I assumed that I was going to rejoin my squadron when my sick leave was over, but shortly towards the end of my leave, a signal arrived, or telegram arrived, as it was called in those days, saying that I was to report to Odeon to pick up an aircraft to take back to France.
What month have we reached now?
This is December, I think, around December, beginning of December. I reported to Odeon, and there was a Blenheim 4, which I was told that I had to take to Amiens-Glissy, where I thought 59 Squadron was based, but in fact they weren't based there. They were now based at Poix with 53 Squadron. But I was told to take this aircraft to Amiens-Glissy. I then thought that I would return to 53 Squadron. I had no navigator, and I had no gunner. I was entirely on my own. I took off from Odium and I crossed into France about Berck-sur-Mer. The weather was not very good. The cloud base was about 700 or 800 feet. And the visibility wasn't good. And I was flying at about 500 feet. And just as I crossed in, what I assume was French anti-aircraft opened fire. And they hit me, and both my engines failed. And I crash landed in a field just near, I know all these places normally, you see, but I'm afraid my memory's a little bit. I crash landed in a field just near Crécy-en-Pontoise. This, of course, is the close to the famous battlefield where the Battle of Crecy was fought. I wasn't seriously hurt, but again, I banged my head on the front windscreen to the extent that I was once again returned to the hospital at Arras, where I spent another few days, and I was then sent back to UK. And that was the end of my association with No. 53 Squadron, because in January 1940 I was posted to No. 1 Flying Training School, which was a fleet air flying training school at Netherhaven in Wiltshire, as a flying instructor.
I think the next time that you came to an operational squadron was in 41 with 25 Squadron with night fighter operations. Can you tell me about that, please?
Well, before I tell you about that, I might just tell you of one incident that happened while I was at Netherhaven. We were equipped there with the Harvard and the Battle to start with. And initially, the Battles were ordinary Battle ones. They were just the ordinary bomber battle, and they had put a dual control set in the position that was normally occupied by the rear gunner. The whole arrangement wasn't terribly satisfactory. Later on, we got the Battle 2, which was a purpose-built dual aircraft and was actually quite a nice aeroplane. But this was the Battle 1. When we were carrying out instrument flying training, whereas normally the instructor sat in the back and the students sat in the front, with instrument flying training, the student sat in the back where he was under a hood, and the instructor sat in the front where he could keep a good watch out for other aircraft. One day I was, and this was in July 1940, I think it was about July the 20th or 21st, somewhere around about then. I had taken off to give dual blind flying instruction to a student who I think was a Royal Marine. Not that that's terribly important. We took off and we headed towards Southampton, Clearly, we were not going to go anywhere near Southampton because otherwise the air raid sirens would have been set off. And so I was just letting him settle down before giving him an instruction to turn to starboard. All of a sudden, what turned out to be a Messerschmitt 110 came up alongside us at about between 50 and 100 yards. I had never seen a 110 in my life before, and if it hadn't been for the big black crosses on the side, or big black cross on the side, I might have thought it was an aircraft flying out of Boscombe Down, which of course was an experimental airfield. It took me a bit of a while to suddenly hoist in that this was a German aircraft. As I say, it had a black cross on the side, and I think it had an orange letter of some sort, but I can't really remember. He was overtaking us at the time, and all of a sudden the rear gunner opened fire. By this time, of course, I'd realised what was happening, and I opened the throttle fully, pulled the stick back. Fortunately, there was quite a bit of cloud around, and started to climb for cloud that was just above us. But there was a loud bang, and obviously we'd been hit, but I didn't know where. And the last I saw of him was that he was starting to turn towards me. And of course, as we all know, he carried considerable armament in the front. However, I made the cloud, and I turned onto a northwesterly course, feeling that he must be operating very close to the extreme of his range and that he wouldn't be able to follow me very far. I might say the student in the back was still unaware of what was happening. Well, I hadn't been in the cloud very long before it became patently obvious where we'd been hit, because the engine started to run very rough and the radiator temperatures started to go up and the oil pressure started to go down. And so I came out of cloud, hoping against hope that the 110 had disappeared, and found myself over Warminster. Well, I'd hoped to try and get down on one of the five airfields that ran up the Salisbury Plain: Old Sarum, Boscombe Down, High Post, Netherhaven, or Uphaven. But it was clear, by the way my engine was beginning to fail, that I wasn't going to make it. Well, we had abandoned night flying out of Netherhaven because of the possibility of getting attacked, and we were now night flying out of a field at Shrewton. And it was to this field I was going to try and get down. I was trying my battle down in this field. As I was getting near to Shrewton, it was obvious I wasn't going to make it. And anybody who knows the Salisbury Plain will know that it's not a flat area at all. It's very undulating, comprises of a lot of little humps and hollows, and quite a lot of tree area as well. Anyway, I managed to put this thing down on the side of a hill, and we skidded along and hit a grain silo that belonged to a farm. And my head jerked forward again, and I hit my face on the windshield in front of me. And although I wasn't rendered unconscious, I was a bit dazed. In the meantime, of course, I had informed the chap in the back what had happened. he was unhurt, and he got out of the aeroplane and he ran forward and he helped me out and sat me on the wing and then ran to the farmhouse, which was not very far away. And about minutes later, the farmer's wife, I assume, with a pot of tea and some cups and one or two other people arrived, and subsequently the ambulance arrived from Netheravon and took me back, and 2 days later I was sent to the hospital in Torquay, where I spent the next month.
When about was that you had the accident?
This was in July. It was about the 21st. In fact, the interesting thing about it is, I always am rather amused about this, because, as you may well know, to qualify to have fought in the Battle of Britain, you must have fought between two particular dates. And there's been a lot of controversy recently, and in fact I've got a book that was written by somebody making the point that the Battle of Britain didn't really end when it did. It went on and extended right through the winter of 1940, and making claims that were quite a lot of people killed in operations after that, which could well have been called an extension of the Battle of Britain, and feels that they too ought to have been included in the award of the Battle of Britain Star, whatever it was called. But I've often amusingly wondered that, bearing in mind that I was shot down in this period, whether in fact I took part in the Battle of Britain or not. Of course I didn't, but it's a rather amusing thought anyway. It's quite interesting that one of the first aircraft I flew when I got back from hospital in September 1940 was this Battle that I crash-landed just before I'd left, so it obviously wasn't as badly damaged as that. Of course, those of us particularly who had already been in operational squadrons were doing our damnedest to try and get back to squadrons, but we were constantly being told that flying instructors were just as important as operational pilots, because we were turning out pilots that were badly needed. And of course in 1940 this was true, and quite a number of our naval pilots in fact went to RAF fighter squadrons, some of whom were killed actually in the Battle of Britain. But I'm afraid it was something that to we young bloods didn't really carry much weight. But they refused to let us go. And round about towards the end of 1940, we were told that this flying training school was going to be transferred from Netheravon to Rhodesia. And I realised that if that ever happened, there was any chance of my getting into a squadron again was absolutely nil. I was absolutely desperate. I didn't know what to do. I got a further interview with the station commander, who repeated what had been said before and told me to go away and not to bother him anymore. And so in desperation, I went to the medical officer who had been responsible for sending me to Torquay after my crash landing. And I said to him, I explained to him my dilemma. What I thought he could do, I do not know, but in fact, he said to me, well, there's nothing I can do. All I can do, he said, is this. He said, I can say that you have had a reoccurrence of the problem that occurred when you had your crash landing, and I think you ought to go back to Torquay for another period. And he said, while you're there, it'll be up to you to do whatever you can to get yourself into a squadron, if it is possible. He said, that's all I can do for you. I said, okay, I'll take it. So I found myself back in hospital in Torquay, but of course I was a sort of walking patient and was able to enjoy all the benefits of being in the place, which were considerable. And while I was down there, my friend Jasper Reed, who'd been in 53 Squadron with me and who'd also been badly injured, he was there as well, and he was also intent on trying to get into a squadron. We didn't know how we were going to achieve it. After all, a hospital is not the best place to try and do these things from. But all of a sudden, an AMO came round saying that, in effect, that pilots were badly needed for night fighter squadrons, and that a team or teams would be sent round the country testing people's night vision, and those who had above average night vision would automatically be posted to night fighter squadrons. And it so happened that one of these teams was coming down to Torquay, not to the hospital, but was going to operate in the town of Torquay, the following week. So Jasper and I put our names down, and sure enough, the next week we reported to this place, and the person leading the team was a woman, a civil servant of, I don't know what age, but she was in her 40s, or she may have been 50, I really don't know. But she seemed to us fairly old at our young age. We arrived, and there were one or two other people there. I don't know where they'd come from. We had to sit in a room with dark glasses on. Then we were taken into another room, and in the middle of this room was a sort of octagonal magic lantern, about 3 feet from it was a white line, a white circle drawn round this thing, and on the edge of this circle were these chairs that we were going to sit on. And the idea was that we would sit there, and in the dark, and this magic lantern would be lit up, and it would show certain images. And we'd been told the sort of images we were likely to see. They would be tanks or ships or aircraft or something like that. We were given a general idea of the type of image it was likely to be, you see. We were given a board with a pencil, and we were attached to the back of these chairs by a clip to avoid us leaning forward. And the woman patrolled round behind us while this was going on. Well, the first lot of images came on, and I couldn't see them for love nor money. And I was absolutely desperate. And I noticed that she was on the other side of the room. I quickly unclipped and I leant forward until I was only a matter of inches from the thing, and I saw it was a tank and an aeroplane and a ship or something. I quickly wrote it down and clipped myself back again, by which time she'd come round behind us. And I went through the whole of this thing, doing this thing, unclipping myself, having a quick look and clipping myself again. I was just lucky that she was never anywhere near me at the time. Then they